Then a friend emailed me about it as well. Everyone is talking about it. We finished the conversation and I hung up the phone in a daze. I pulled up the email account associated with the old website, which I hadn't looked at in forever. The bottom of the list of emails was all spam. But yesterday morning, real notes started flooding in from people who saw the coffee piece. Not all of the messages were positive, but I didn't mind. My writing was getting traction again. I spent the rest of the afternoon reading one email after another, then searching around to see all the blogs and websites that were talking about what I'd created. When the kids woke up, I let them watch TV so that I could keep reading. An electric energy surged through me as I absorbed the feedback on my work. It was thrilling to be back in the mix of things again, even for this fleeting moment. The work that I did in my daily life was hidden. Nobody saw it but Joe and the kids, or maybe my mom if she came over for dinner. I missed being part of the marketplace of ideas and missed it desperately. That familiar ache came over me. The ache to ignite my blue flame, to do this work that I loved and share it with the world. I wanted to ride the wave of momentum from this viral essay. I could offer to write freelance pieces for all the sites that were talking about this coffee piece. I could update my blog more often. At some point, I could even think about writing a book, something I'd wanted to do since I was a child. And maybe all of this would translate into a little income, which would relieve the financial pressure Joe was under. No sooner had these thoughts crossed my mind than I was brought back to the reality of my situation. It was the bookstore cafe incident all over again. Not now, I reminded myself. Do what you need to do as a mom, make the sacrifices, get through it. This time will pass before you know it. Chapter 7. Loaves of Bread. With Donald's birth, before my clotting disorder was diagnosed, I'd gone to a midwife-staffed birthing center. We had long conversations about how I could best be empowered in my birthing experience and carefully chose the scented candles that would burn in the room. Now that I had to have labor induced in a hospital to manage clotting issues, my birth strategy was so simple that I didn't even need to write it down. Plan for relaxation? All the drugs you can legally give me. Vision for how we handle the labor process? I don't really have much of a say in the matter, do I? So let's go back to talking about the drugs. At the end of August, our new daughter, Lucy, was born. I had to stay in the hospital for 3 days, and I always enjoyed the time with just me and the new baby. When I changed her diaper for the first time after Joe and the rest of the family returned home, I stopped to gaze at this new person in front of me. My hospital bed was pushed up next to a picture window with a view of a courtyard, and the late afternoon light was so soft and perfect, it looked like we were in a photo shoot for a greeting card. Lucy's little legs and arms moved erratically as her brain raced to figure out how all of this works, her chubby doll's face occasionally scrunching up in confusion. I closed my eyes, sitting in quiet gratitude for this gift I'd been given. It was never more clear to me than at moments like this that parenting was a sacred duty. We'd only been home from the hospital for a week when the pressures of life made themselves present once again. I ended up delirious and feverish with what turned out to be mastitis. As soon as that was taken care of, Joe had to go back to work. On top of that, we still didn't have a car that fit the whole family. Joe had his eye on a 5-year-old minivan he'd found on Craigslist and was trying to figure out a way to get it. There was a time when I would have launched into a Braveheart-style rallying cry about how I could not be a minivan-driving person. Now, I would have happily driven the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile if it fit 3 car seats. Joe had been in touch with the owner of the minivan and was pretty sure it wasn't going anywhere, but we were still $1,000 short. One evening, we were sitting in the living room after the kids went to bed, me reading P.G. Wodehouse with the baby sleeping in my arms, Joe doing something on his laptop. The baby and I both jumped when he let out a startled shout. "What is it?" I asked. "This deposit into our checking account. Did you make that?"
"No, what deposit?"
"It's for $800.
"No way. Let me see."
He turned around the laptop. Sure enough, there was a deposit for $812.77.
"It wasn't a check," Joe said.
"It was an electronic direct deposit, but I don't recognize the company name that sent it."
"Wait."
I leaned in to get a good look at the organization's name.
"I do."
"This was from the company that served ads on my old website where I wrote humor essays. I completely forgot that I still had ads up on that coffee order piece that went viral again. This must be revenue from all the traffic it got."
Joe moved to take the laptop back, but I grabbed it to stop him. I wanted to look at that number for another long moment, to savor this symbol that so many people had responded to something I created.
The traffic on that page was now back to almost zero. But that dollar amount symbolized my brief return to the marketplace of ideas.
"Want to hear something crazy?" Joe said when I finally released the computer. "My mom just gave me a late birthday check for $200. We now have exactly enough money to get the minivan."
"Oh, wow."
There was a saying in Catholic circles that every baby comes with a loaf of bread under its arms, originally conveyed to me by a woman whose grandmother raised 9 children in an abandoned boxcar in Mexico. The idea is that unexpected graces always come into your life when you're open to the people whom God sends your way, whether it's babies or friends in need or anyone else. I couldn't help but call that phrase to mind now, even though the skeptic in me had always hesitated to embrace it. As if Joe heard my thoughts, he said, "They say that every baby comes with a loaf of bread under its arms."
"Well, I don't think we can say that this ad revenue was dropped down from heaven or anything."
Joe looked at me with knowing amusement. "Old atheist habits die hard, huh?" Despite his doggedly linear way of thinking and his rigorous academic training, he was usually the one of the two of us who was most open to seeing the divine hand at work in our lives. "I'm just saying that I doubt it's God's top priority to send me cash from some smack-talking thing I wrote when there are people all over the world who need this money a whole lot more than we do."
"Yeah. I'm not suggesting that God is a big ATM machine in the sky."
"Then what are you saying?"
"I don't know. Maybe it's not about the money per se. Maybe God is trying to get your attention."
Whether it was God or just a fortunate turn of events, it was quite effective at getting my attention. In the weeks that followed, I kept thinking about it. I had wanted to jump back into this work when this essay first went viral, but now that I saw that I could potentially bring in some income from it, my excitement had doubled in intensity. I told myself over and over that I could get back to it soon enough, but I just had to wait until the kids were older.
"You're doing the right thing. This is what good mothers do. It'll go by quickly."
I repeated these words like a mantra, as if I could force myself to believe that they were true if I just said them enough. The reality was that I had no peace. Now that Lucy was here, that sense that we were meant to have a big family had only grown stronger. The fact that more babies continue to feel right, even in the midst of the absolute chaos that came with having 3 children under age 3, made me think that it definitely had to be some special call from God. And I was starting to see that I simply could not keep ignoring it. So what then of my personal passions? If I did have more children, when would I ever get to this work that I loved? I was trying to follow the roadmap to perfect motherhood, but I only felt more lost every day. I walked around in a state of perpetual unease and confusion, kind of like how you feel just before you realize you have the wrong map.
Chapter 8. A Friendship is Born. I cradled the phone on my shoulder so that I could use both hands to stir baby food. I had called Hallie to offer her congratulations on her 4th pregnancy.
She and I had gotten together a few more times since the infamous beer bong playdate the summer before, and now we talked by phone to trade recipes or swap parenting tips once or twice a month. I still had trouble connecting with someone who was so much better at life than I was, but I increasingly enjoyed her company. I was asking Hallie if she had any names picked out when Donald and Lane turned up the TV in the living room to cosmic blast level. "I'm sorry, Hallie," I shouted as I rushed for the volume button. "They always do this. There's this song about that old cartoon Jabberjaw. The Cartoon Network plays it during the commercials about 100 times a day, and the kids turn up the volume every time it comes on. They have this dance they do."
"Oh, that's so funny. That's..."
I didn't hear the rest of what she said because of Donald and Lane's protests that I'd ruined their dance.
"I'm sorry, what did you say?" I asked when I got them settled down.
"Jabberjaw, that's Dan's band song."
"Dan who?"
"Dan, my husband."
"I don't think I follow."
She was clearly misunderstanding me. This song was by a punk band whose name I was vaguely familiar with from when they toured through Austin in the late 90s. I wasn't sure what the connection was to her church employee husband.
"That song is by the band Pain, right?"
"That's Dan. He was the lead singer. That's so funny. I could hear his voice in the background when the song came on." I needed a minute to process this. I had listened to and commented on this song dozens of times before. Just last week, I joked to Joe that it was the soundtrack to my crazy life right now. It came on the television so often that I knew all the words. I might have even been to a Pain concert at some point in college. Hallie's husband was the lead singer?
"I'm so confused. I thought you said Dan works for a church," I said.
"That's his career now. The band was..." She stifled what seemed to be a wry laugh. "That was in his old life."
"So wait, how did you guys meet?"
"I went to see one of his shows when he played the Gilman in Berkeley. This probably sounds crazy, but as soon as he stepped out onto the stage, it was love at first sight."
This is not how I would have imagined that my devout homemaker friend met her husband.
"Were you guys religious then?"
She laughed.
"No, not at all." She went on to tell me the story of how, at age 19, she moved from her home in San Francisco to follow her new punk rocker boyfriend back to Mobile, Alabama, only to have him tell her shortly after she arrived that he had had a profound spiritual transformation and God might be calling him to be a monk. I shrieked and guffawed as she shared the details of this wild ride that led Dan to walk away from the band just as it was poised to become famous, and how all of this led to Hallie's own conversion to Christianity. As you can probably guess, Dan eventually decided that he wasn't meant to be a monk, and now we're about to have four kids, Hallie said at the end of her story. I shook my head in wonder at everything I just heard.
Okay, we need to talk.
Sure, I think I have a few more minutes before the kids wake up from naps.
No, I mean get together in person, just the two of us, and talk.
In the months of our burgeoning friendship, I had hesitated to open up to her. I imagined that she wouldn't be able to relate to someone like me, who didn't always fit perfectly into the mold of happy Christian mom. Now, after this conversation, the wall that had separated us had been demolished. Or maybe I finally saw that it never existed at all. We made plans for that evening, and when I got off the phone, I was jubilant. I gave 7-month-old Lucy a big mouthful of food, and we smiled at one another. A funny expression crossed her face, like she was happy but thinking about something, and I assumed it was her picking up on the joy in my demeanor.
"Things just might be looking up, right, Lucy?" I said to her.
She let out an explosive sneeze, and baby food splattered all over my face. Joe was at the office late, but my mom kindly offered to babysit so that I could make this chat with Hallie happen. We met at my favorite bookstore, which was the first time I'd been back since the day I'd seen that mom spending quality time with her daughter. That memory inspired me to skip the small talk with Hallie. I spoke with the intensity of an investigative reporter about to crack the case of the century as I opened the discussion. "So you used to run in San Francisco cool kid circles. You went to punk shows at the Gilman. Now you're a religious stay-at-home mom with lots of little kids. Was anything about that transition rough for you?" Hallie seemed surprised but delighted by my bluntness, as if she'd been starved for real conversation too.
Are you kidding? Pretty much all of it. I've had to learn everything the hard way.
Like me, she came from a small family, one sibling in her case, and had little experience with kids and babies when she got married. Her mother was a strong feminist who ran a neonatal intensive care unit at a prestigious hospital in the Bay Area and had always hoped that her daughter would have an equally impressive career herself. To be honest, I still struggle a lot.
But you seem so perfect.
She shook her head, her voice heavy with sincerity.
No, no, I'm far from perfect.
She glanced over her shoulder as if to confirm that nobody else would hear us. Then she lowered her voice and said,
On Monday, I went to the eye doctor's office, and it was one of those days, you know? The baby was up all night, the kids had colds, we had bills to pay. Anyway, I go in for my appointment, and they had rescheduled it without calling me, and now they couldn't get me in. They were completely unapologetic about it, even after I explained the insane amount of effort it took for me to get childcare to come out here. One woman actually rolled her eyes at me.
Yikes, that's when I go sit in my car and cry.
Maybe that's what I should have done.
So what did you do?
I screamed at them.
What? I guffawed. Seriously? I could not imagine Hallie, with her impeccable manners and quiet, graceful demeanor, raising her voice at anyone.
Yeah, it was bad. I was so loud that everyone else in the room stopped to stare.
She leaned in closer, laughing as she spoke.
I feel like a crazy woman, Jen. I mean, I think they were probably about to call the cops. I seriously can never go back to that doctor's office again.
We giggled as I shared some of my own less than dignified moments that had happened recently. I knew that it was probably not a compliment to my personality that I liked this woman 1,000 times more now that I knew that she occasionally screamed at strangers, but I didn't care. It had been so long since I had had a real connection with someone who truly understood my life and shared my imperfections. I was overcome with wave after wave of relief. We talked about everything. She told me that Dan had lost his job, and they were worried about him being able to find a new one. We discussed our shared concerns for the pressures that our husbands faced. I told her about my recently rekindled love of writing and the money I made from the old piece that went viral. I told her about how I thought I should set all of that stuff aside until the kids were older, and yet I had no peace about that decision.
Yes, she said so loudly that the man next to us turned his head. Oh my gosh, yes, I have been thinking about these exact same things. And listen, we're not the only ones. I'm on an email list for the moms group at my church, and so many women are struggling with this stuff.
Thus began one of the most honest, fascinating conversations I'd had in years. Normally, I loved the ambiance of a bookstore coffee shop. I loved sneaking peeks at the stacks of titles people brought to their tables to peruse while they sipped their drinks. I was energized by the smells of the roasted beans and freshly bound books. But none of that existed to me now.
Honestly, do you know any woman who has young children and is content in this area of her life? I asked.
Hallie thought for a moment.
I mean, I'm sure they exist, but no, I don't.
At Joe's office Easter party, the wife of one of his coworkers mentioned that she was starring in a play at the local community theater. She had a 1-year-old at home, and she couldn't even talk about her big role without mentioning the guilt she felt in every other sentence. Hallie had just gone to a women's group at church, where a mom said that she used to be a musician in an orchestra. This sweet woman kept saying she was fine with setting aside her music to raise her kids, but she started tearing up before she could finish.
Why don't we talk about this more often? I said, my voice becoming more confident the longer this conversation went on. Why do we have to whisper about these kinds of feelings like we're talking about having side jobs as drug dealers?
Before Hallie could respond, I knew the answer to my own question. At least my answer. I rarely voice these kinds of feelings to anyone except Joe because I was afraid that it would come across like I didn't love my kids. I worried that if I said, I am really unhappy with my life right now. It would come across like I was saying, I'm really unhappy that I'm a mother. I didn't think anyone would understand. Hallie and I talked for another hour about our mess of emotions on the subject, and then we both had to get home. We exchanged warm goodbyes and promised to chat tomorrow to continue the conversation. I walked to my car in the comfortable air of a late spring evening, my senses tuned to absorb every detail of this moment. Hallie and I didn't come up with any answers. We had no grand solutions to these problems that so many women like us faced. But I had something that was at least as good as a tidy solution and might even be better. The joy of encountering someone else who was asking the same questions. Chapter 9. Shot in the Dark. That night, after everyone else was asleep, I crept downstairs and grabbed my laptop. Cross-legged on the couch in my pajamas, I hunted among my files for a document that I hadn't looked at in years. I finally found it in an old folder, stored among a graveyard of unfinished essays, database schemas from old projects, and even a few college papers. I'd called it goals-writing.txt. Even seeing the name sparked a warm happiness. I used to review this file almost weekly back when I was running the old website where I wrote the piece about people's coffee orders and their personality types. I clicked it open. When the words filled the screen, sensations of hope and excitement came with them, like a familiar smell on a favorite coat that had been stored away in a chest. It was a list of everything I once dreamed of accomplishing. The bookstore conversation with Hallie had gotten me thinking, was there some way I could get back to this work sooner rather than later? Was I missing something in my assessment of the entire situation? I had hoped that reviewing this file might spark some ideas. Nothing grabbed my attention, and I was about to close the document. Then I noticed the very last note. Pitch book idea to Ted. The two words, Ted and book, sent me careening back into a land of dreams that I hadn't visited in a very long time. Around the time Joe and I got engaged, a literary agent named Ted contacted me to introduce himself. He said that he'd come across my essays on my website and liked my writing style. He was starting a new literary agency and told me to let him know if I ever had a book idea I'd like to pitch to him. I was so thrilled at the prospect that I'd stayed up all night sketching out possibilities, but I couldn't pull a coherent vision together. Then wedding plans and marriage and babies got in the way, and now it had been years since we'd been in touch. With every month that passed, Ted grew more and more out of my reach. He was no longer a new agent who might be open to taking a risk on unheard-of authors. Sometimes I checked his agency website to keep up with what he represented, and I regularly saw best-selling titles. Remembering all of this rekindled the strongest and most consistent desire of my life, like a flame blooming instantly when kindling is thrown onto glowing coals. For me, that was my desire to write a book. It started when I was 9 years old. At that time, my dad had only recently recovered from colon cancer. Then the economy crashed and he was laid off from his job as a construction project manager. Months went by, then a year, and he hadn't been able to find work. My mom's salary as a bookkeeper was spread dangerously thin, and the tension in the house rose daily. A family we knew had their home and most of their possessions taken away by creditors just a week before Christmas. Another had a repossessed car towed away while the kids watched in their pajamas. At night, I often heard my parents speaking in hushed tones in the kitchen, and I sometimes wondered if we were next. They did their best to shield me from the stress we were under, but worry was always present behind my dad's eyes. But when we talked about writing books, his demeanor became light. He smiled easily as he explained a plot shift in his Special Forces novel based on his experience as a Green Beret during the Vietnam era. He'd often let me stay up past bedtime because we were ensconced in front of the TRS-80 computer, hammering out the details of his book or mine. His enthusiasm was tireless as he helped me tighten the chapters in my novel, a thriller about a fourth-grade girl's Machiavellian ascent up the social ladder of her elementary school. when we escaped into the land of stories, everything was okay again. And sometimes we dared to dream of having our tales published. Books were woven into the fabric of our lives, spilling out from overstuffed shelves onto coffee tables and bedside stands. All three of us in our little family used the written word as our primary escape from the world, sometimes spending entire Sundays lounging in the den, each of us lost in a novel, the only sound the occasional turning of a page. In our many moves across the country, I often spent weeks, sometimes months, without a single friend. But books were always my escape hatch. For my dad and me, the idea of contributing to this world of the printed word felt like gaining admittance to a magical realm that we'd long admired but had only seen from the outside. As I was pondering all of this, my hands drifted across the keyboard. I searched online for news about Ted's agency without even consciously deciding to do it. I scanned reviews for a few of the most recent books he'd represented. Then I typed his name absentmindedly into the search box on my email. I was only planning to look through my correspondence with Joe about Ted's agency, but the search suggested his email address. I sat up straight, my body ready for action, though I had no idea what that action might be. Was this still a working address? He may very well have disabled this one and adopted a new one as his agency grew. I stared at it for at least 10 minutes, trying to figure out what to do with this unexpected information. I decided to shoot over a note. Chances were that the email would bounce anyway. I typed up a quick message reintroducing myself. I let him know that I was planning to get back into the writing world one of these days. I also mentioned that I had a blog and that multiple readers had told me that I should turn the subject matter into a book one day, which was technically true because Joe and Hallie had suggested it. Before I could talk myself out of it, I sent it. I waited for the immediate bounce back of a disabled address. It didn't come. I was realistic enough to know that I probably would not get a reply. Literary agents are bombarded with dozens of legitimate queries per week and often don't have time to respond to all of those, let alone pointless notes from random people just saying hello. But this email wasn't about the reply. The message here was more to me than to this agent. It was a concrete act of hope, a signal to myself that I was not going to let go of my passions without a fight. The next morning, I dashed out my first real blog update in more than a week, my words brimming with energy. I found out a few days later that Donald and Lane were accepted into a Mother's Day Out program that our parish offered 2 mornings per week. On top of that, Lucy had started reliably sleeping through the night. Just as we eased into this new season of routine and predictability, it occurred to me one morning that the timing of my cycle was off this month. I wasn't worried about it, but I grabbed an old pregnancy test from under the sink. I was in the middle of going through the motion of glancing at the result while tossing it into the trash when I froze. It was positive. Baby number 4 was on the way. Chapter 10. Wholeness of vision. Was this planned? The nurse wanted to know when I came to the doctor's office to get my blood thinner prescription. It's hard to say whether she was more confused by the fact that I didn't have a clear answer to that question or by the fact that I was already in there with another pregnancy in the first place. The problem was that I didn't know how to answer. One of the salient features of natural family planning is that the effectiveness level varies alongside your motivation level. If a woman were strongly motivated to make sure that pregnancy didn't happen in any given month, she could track her fertility signs meticulously and could likely get her NFP effectiveness rate up to around 98%. I'd just seen a study by the European Society for Human Reproduction and Embryology that showed that NFP, if practiced a certain way, was as effective as the birth control pill. But in my case, NFP forced my secret feelings to the surface. It's a sacrifice-based method of birth control, and each month, when the time to make those sacrifices rolls around, it makes you question just how serious you are about avoiding pregnancy right now. As it turned out, Joe and I weren't that serious. The way I practiced it, my NFP effectiveness rate was probably around 70%. How do you not know if it was planned or not? The nurse asked. Because I don't see the answer to that question as being binary, but as residing on a spectrum, I said. I started to go into my spiel about how I no longer subscribed to the false dichotomy of planned versus unplanned, but when she looked at me like I was insane, I stopped. After I picked up my first box of blood thinner shots from the pharmacy, I started heading home. I was stopped at a light where I would turn left to go north to my house, but I surprised myself by jerking the steering wheel to go right instead, toward the church. Our parish held a noon mass every weekday that lasted less than an hour. I pulled onto the highway going south, and soon the cross on top of the broad bronze dome peeked out from behind industrial buildings up ahead. I slid into a pew a few rows back from the front, the bag of shots from the pharmacy sitting next to me. The priest entered in a quiet processional, reciting the entrance antiphon as a poem since there was no choir at weekday services. On Sundays, this grand building would be packed with 1,000 people, but today it was only me and 100 or so other attendees. The church had been constructed recently, but had old-world character. Its wide columns supporting a lofty, intricately designed ceiling with a long barrel vault that led to the 10-foot crucifix at the front of the sanctuary. Everything about this structure radiated peace. The smooth lines of the architecture, the way the stained glass diffused the harsh summer sunlight into a warm glow. Behind the crucifix was an enormous replica of Raphael's painting La Disputa, in which philosophers' robes billowed gracefully under the rolling clouds of heaven. Even the air felt laden with the presence of God, thick with graces waiting to be bestowed. I closed my eyes, hoping that some of it would rub off on me. I'd come here as an act of surrender. I'd been trying to run from that call to have a big family for years, and now it was time to give up. I had exhausted my ability to resist this plan for my life. It felt too right, and I was too incompetent with family planning, to keep fighting it. And what I wanted in exchange for my surrender was peace. I was happy about this baby, and even happy in a way about this strange plan for my life. But all of my concerns about managing my household and doing the work that I loved still filled me with worry. I was kind of surprised when the mass ended, and I felt just as conflicted as when I'd arrived. I knew that I wasn't supposed to approach worship like I was bartering at a flea market, saying, "Hey God, if I give you 45 minutes of my afternoon, you have to give me peace and perfect clarity in return." But that was kind of how I was hoping it would play out. I was backing the car out of the parking place when I realized I'd forgotten my shots back on the pew, so I reparked and rushed toward the church. The street value of that box was $2,000. Luckily, my insurance paid for it, so I ran as if I'd left a diamond necklace inside. My pace slowed, however, when I remembered that the local black market probably didn't have a big demand from people wanting to shoot blood thinner needles into their stomachs. I retrieved the box and hurried back out. But when I pushed open the 12-foot-tall oak door, I paused. A small crowd had gathered in front of the building, people kissing and greeting one another in the wide, paved courtyard. The church door closed with a hefty thud behind me, just as I sensed the message, "Stay. Watch." I felt powerfully drawn to wait and see what event was taking place, as if an unseen hand had grabbed my arm to stop me. There were about 30 people gathered, the ages ranging from elderly to newborn, and they all spoke Spanish. A young woman with a professional camera snapped pictures. I gathered from snippets of conversation that they were here for a wedding rehearsal. Watching their warm greetings transported me back into some of my fondest childhood memories. My grandfather spent most of his adult life working as an engineer in Latin America, and my dad was raised in Mexico. Once my grandparents moved back to Texas, when they were in their 60s, they became tapped into the local community of recent immigrants. They used their fluency in Spanish to help folks navigate U.S. culture, and I had fond recollections of their living room being filled with loud, jovial conversation en español. The Mexican community I knew then had an entirely different way of seeing the world, one in which more people meant more fun. As a kid, I noticed whenever we'd visit Tampico or Mexico City that our friends there seemed to live in this strange world where you didn't stress about new folks showing up, whether it was an unexpected pregnancy or a neighbor stopping by or a niece who needed to move in with her three kids for a while. I appreciated this people-first lifestyle, but never considered it to be something I would adopt for myself. My introverted, individualistic nature was at the very core of my identity. In fact, I'd already decided that if this new baby were a girl, her middle name would be Frances, in honor of the 14th century saint named Francis of Rome, who was so socially anxious that she collapsed from stress during the parties surrounding her wedding. That was me. I was the person who needed to minimize having people all up in my face. Inviting people into your life leads to unpredictability and noise and mess, all things I sought to avoid. And yet this mentality had been eroding over the past few years. Now, I felt it start to crumble. People like this family here in front of me today seem to understand something about the meaning of life that I would do well to understand myself. The family gathered together for a group picture, presumably to commemorate this wedding rehearsal. They smiled in unison, and just as the photographer began snapping rapid-fire pictures, a baby took off his mother's floppy sun hat and waved it in the air. The woman was attempting to get it back when a gust of wind whipped it out of her son's hands. Seconds later, the group would scatter as everyone scurried after the hat. But for a brief moment, the woman burst out in unexpected laughter just as everyone turned toward her, their faces registering a mix of delight and confusion. The photographer got the shot. It would be a fantastic picture, the hat floating above the baby, everyone's faces full of emotion. Certainly, it would make it into the wedding album. I could see this group of people gathering at a family party, perhaps a year from now, and chuckling together when they pointed to this shot. Then I imagined it being brought out decades later, perhaps at an anniversary celebration, and everyone would marvel at how young they looked in the picture. Then, one day, it would probably end up in a box in an attic somewhere. Perhaps, far in the future, someone would find it again. All the motion and vivid colors that I saw before me right now would be trapped behind a faded image. Many of the faces would belong to people who had passed on. The baby would now be an old man, and people would chuckle to see what he looked like as an infant. Imagining the story arc of this family across the generations called a phrase to mind: wholeness of vision. I'd first heard these words used by Sheldon Vonnegut, author of the classic memoir A Severe Mercy. His late wife, Davy, had experienced a crisis pregnancy as a teenager and gave up the baby for adoption. Sheldon and Davy did not have children together, and after she died, he went off in search of Davy's child, whom he called Little Lost Marion. When he found her, he encountered a delightful woman who worked as a nurse and had three children of her own. He grew so close to Marion that she thought of him as a father. Vonnegut wrote fondly of how Marion and her family enriched his life, as well as the lives of many others. Clearly, the world was a better place with them in it. In his final years, this led him to reflect on the importance of having a wholeness of vision when it comes to new life. He could validate the difficulties that his beloved Davy faced with her unexpected pregnancy. But now, like reading a book to its finish, he could see that that situation, as painful as it was just one part of a much bigger story. Wholeness of vision. That's what I was missing in all of my tortured calculations about family size. That was, perhaps, the secret that our friends from Mexico understood that I was missing. When I thought of this pregnancy or imagined others after it, my mind immediately conjured a picture of me fumbling for a diaper at 3 o'clock in the morning while cradling a screaming infant in one arm and shouting to Joe, "I can't do this!" I never imagined that same baby as a 25-year-old passing the gravy at my Thanksgiving dinner table, or as a 50-year-old walking into my hospital room with a bouquet of flowers. My controlling tendencies led me to fixate so much on my immediate problems that I couldn't see past them. I tended to live my life ruled by the tyranny of the immediate. I lacked a wholeness of vision, and I now saw that I'd never be able to accurately discern matters of family size without it. I thought of our own funny pictures that had been snapped recently. Lucy sitting next to Joe, looking quite concerned as she monitored his work fixing a leak under the sink. Lane in her bright red pigtails, caught in mid-giggle as my dad read a book to her during one of his visits. Donald holding a lamb when my mom took the kids to a petting zoo. One day, these would be historic photographs, not casual depictions of recent events. They would represent people whose time on this earth had drawn to a close, their impact on the world fully known, their stories now complete. The daily problems I carried with me as I snapped each of these photos would be long forgotten. I needed to start making my big life choices with that perspective in mind. The group now broke up, some people drifting into the church to start the wedding rehearsal. This moment had given me the peace I'd been searching for. I knew, when I looked at our family's life with a wholeness of vision, that the path of being unusually open to babies was the right one for us. I still had questions, a lot of questions, in fact, about what the details would look like. What about the fact that I was such a bad homemaker that the kids had goldfish crackers for lunch yesterday? What of my personal passions? Could I really be happy if my primary focus for years to come was managing a house full of babies? I walked back to my car with no answers, only a strong sense that somehow it would all work out. Chapter 11, For the Love of the Blob. We pulled up to my grandfather's house, now driving the minivan we'd been able to purchase thanks to the windfall after Lucy's birth. Yaya was already standing outside. She came to visit about once a month and had planned this trip to coincide with the birthday celebration we were doing for my grandfather. She had her cell phone cradled on her shoulder and appeared to be shouting into it as she approached the vehicle. When she slid open the side door to help us get the kids out, we could hear her end of the conversation. Indeed, she was shouting.
I never said I was going to vote for that man. That's not... No, that's not what I said. Listen, if you want to support that son of a...
Good to see you, I announced loudly to drown out the heated political argument, which was clearly going downhill. In between invectives, Yaya knelt down and hugged the kids, then stood to unstrap Lucy from her car seat. She was now more interested in her grandchildren than in her phone call, so she offered succinct closing thoughts and hung up. Who were you talking to? I asked as I took Lucy from her.
Wrong number.
She grabbed Donald and Lane by the hands and turned to walk toward the front door before I had a chance to inquire further. I followed Yaya down the walkway toward the house, a comforting sense of familiarity growing with each step. My parents and I moved across the country many times in my childhood, and so this house, my grandparents' home, was always a touchstone for me. I'd traveled the same path past the short, neatly trimmed bushes when arriving from our homes in Arizona, North Dakota, West Virginia, and Colorado, as well as countless times from our current home just one city over. To step into the 1970s ranch-style home was to expect it to have the typical musty smell of an older house that had never been renovated. But the air here was always rich with scents of food, this time the spicy aroma of ribs cooking on the back porch grill. Even though he'd just turned 94, my grandfather, whom we called Papaw, regularly treated us to gourmet meals. In fact, he insisted on cooking this dinner even though the celebration was for him. He delighted in pouring love into his only grandchild's family in the form of roasts and crepes and special desserts, all recipes he created himself. My mom was already inside. Papa was my dad's father, but my mom still made it to every dinner, even now that my parents were divorced. She often stopped by his house to have a lemonade with him after she played tennis or just to chat when she was running errands nearby. This was an enormous blessing, especially since my dad's job as an engineer still took him all over the place, his latest projects being in Abu Dhabi and the Cayman Islands. I pushed open the heavy sliding glass door to the back porch where Papa rested in between checking on the ribs. Yaya was already seated near the grill, and Lucy just about leapt from my arms to sit with her. This porch with the simple concrete slab and rusting tin awning was the stage on which so many of my childhood memories played out. My grandmother feeding a squirrel from her hand when I was a young child. A great uncle standing next to the grill in his cowboy hat, loudly telling a joke while Papa dropped catfish fillets into a cast iron skillet full of bubbling oil. Me holding a plastic cup of unsweetened iced tea, making polite chit-chat with guests after my grandmother's funeral when I was 15. I was soaking in the ambiance when Yaya said,
"Jennifer, what are you writing these days?"
I'd just taken a seat in an old aluminum lawn chair with a cushion that was as dry and crumbly as month-old bread. "I'm not really doing that anymore. Not right now, anyway, I said.
Well, that's a shame. Last time we were here, you were so excited when you talked about your blob.
My blog?
Yeah, your blob or whatever. You sure did seem to like that thing.
She spoke of it as if it were a tangible object, which she may very well have imagined it to be.
Yeah, it was fun to play around with. I still update it once in a while, I said. I forced myself to sound casual, but my tone sounded wooden instead, as if I were reading lines from a script.
My writing work is obviously not something I should be putting tons of effort into right now.
I don't follow, Yaya said.
We paused as Papa eased himself to a standing position, both of us watching in case he needed help. He slowly stepped over to the grill and opened the lid. A plume of white smoke mushroomed from inside, enclosing us in a fog that was infused with the rich scents of sage and rib meat.
You know how it is. We've got a new baby on the way. I'm staying home with the kids. I guess I shouldn't be shirking my duties to mess around on the internet.
Yaya shot up in her chair and leaned forward in the determined posture she adopted when she was about to make a proclamation.
Now, wait a minute, Jennifer. Just wait 1 minute. You think you can't do your writing just because you're staying home with the children?
Well, sometimes, yeah.
But it's something you like. How else are you going to take a load off with all these babies running around everywhere?
Right on cue, Lucy swung her chunky arm and knocked over Yaya's plastic mug, sending ice skidding across the ground.
Shoot, I'm worried about these kids if you don't work on this stuff you enjoy. You'll lose your mind, she said with an astonished but jovial laugh.
I couldn't help but smile. Yaya was an endless source of wisdom, like if Yoda had an East Texas accent and a penchant for colorful language. Joe and I often referred to her as the Albert Einstein of common sense. She might need to call us 4 times to figure out how to turn on that VDF machine, DVD player, but her understanding of human nature and innate sense of what decisions will lead people to happy lives were second to none.
I'm not even making money, you know, I said.
Not yet, but if you keep at it, you surely will. But that's beside the point. She turned in her chair to address my grandfather.
Papa, did your mother seem as stressed out as these young mothers today?
Papa set down the tongs on the platform next to the grill, which he'd built himself thanks to his expertise as a civil engineer. He closed the lid and the air cleared. He slowly made his way back to the folding chair next to Yaya and eased himself into the seat.
Oh, Lord, I don't envy these parents today. Everything is so fast. Everyone is so busy.
But your mother had such a hard life, I said.
I've heard your stories about how she'd hand-wash the laundry on a washboard with lye soap. My life is so much easier than hers was.
Papa was born in 1914 and was therefore a living connection to a way of life that was about to be lost to history. He'd known plenty of folks who were born in the 1800s. He'd met men and women who lived through the Civil War. He was one of the last people to know the world before modern technology. His earliest memory was of attending a funeral where the coffin arrived in a horse-drawn hearse. He remembered life without phones or cars or even electricity. He was awed when he first saw a plane fly overhead when he was a teenager. And so I was interested to hear how Papa would contrast my life to his mother's life.
Oh, sure, Jenny, I don't think anyone's life was easy back then. We worked so hard in those days. From can't see to can't see, we used to say, he said, imitating the accent of his Texan loved ones by pronouncing can't so that it rhymed with ain't.
He no longer had a southern accent after years spent working out of the United States, but he could bring it back effortlessly.
But life back then wasn't so stressful as it is today.
Yaya now leaned over to Papa.
Did you know that parents can't even let their children out of their sight these days? What would your mother have done if she had to watch all the kids all day with everything else she had to do to keep the house and the farm going?
Papa laughed.
Oh, I don't know, but none of us would have liked it. I used to send Joey out to play and just told him to come home when the streetlights came on.
That's right, Papa added. My mama hardly saw us during the day. We'd roam around and hunt squirrels, go swimming in the creek when we weren't busy on the farm, usually barefoot, too.
My mom had stepped outside to bring Papa a glass of water, and she chimed in.
That was like us, too. When my brothers and sisters and I got home from school, we'd jump on our bikes and ride all over the neighborhood. Same thing during the summer. My mother had no idea where we were most of the time. Those were different times, weren't they? And here's the other thing, Yaya said, waving her index finger in the air to emphasize her point. People back then weren't going all the time like you girls today. The way I lived, the way Papa lived, you got some rest in the evening. Without TV or computers or all of these phones that blink and beep all the time, there just wasn't that much to do at night. Papa nodded. Once we had a radio, we would listen to that for a while, or maybe study for school by a kerosene lantern, but that was all we did after sundown. Then we'd go to bed. There wasn't much else to keep us up. With smoke still lingering in the air like a hazy flashback scene in a movie, I imagined a typical evening in my grandfather's childhood farmhouse, everyone in that calm, subdued state that you fall into when you're in a room lit only by candlelight. I contrasted it to a typical evening in our house, all bright lights and half-pajamaed kids running down hallways to the soundtrack of endlessly dinging phones. I could picture Papa's mother stepping out the front door of their hand-built wooden home in the afternoon, scanning the horizon for her kids, whom she hadn't seen since they bolted out the door after breakfast. She'd wipe her hands on her apron, ring the brass bell at the front of the porch, then put the last settings on the table before her husband and kids came in from the fields. Since I'd become a parent, I'd had this idea that the perfect mother would spend hours out of each day on the floor with her young children, gazing into their eyes as she slowly articulated the sound of each letter on the educational wooden alphabet blocks they were building into a tower. She would take her four-month-old baby to Mom and Me music classes and sit cross-legged on the floor, clapping her infant's hands to the beats of the nursery songs. Now, I suddenly realized that mothers throughout history never did this. They never had time. Children's primary sources of entertainment were outdoor play and other kids, not their mothers. Yaya took a moment to bounce Lucy on her lap, playfully nuzzling her face into the baby's chubby neck, then returned to me. Here's what I'm saying, Jennifer. Whenever you talk about all that writing stuff you like to do, you look happy. I think that your life as a young mom today is hard. It's not hard like Papa's mom's life was, or Lord, like my life was as a single mother, but it's hard in other ways. You never get to rest your mind. You're stuck in a house with the kids. You're supposed to have your eyes on them all day, every day. Everything's all a ruckus all the time, even at night. I think maybe you modern girls need things like your blogs and your face pages or what have you to keep from losing your minds. Papa had gotten up and eased his way over to the grill, which now exhaled another burst of smoke. It cascaded gracefully over me, and I couldn't tell if my eyes stung from the smoke or from tears. Chapter 12. The Reply. A few days later, Joe and I sat in the front yard while the kids played, trying to figure out how our three-bedroom house was going to accommodate another baby. We had no extra space, like a basement or a finished attic, and my vision for how we could make it all work was getting complicated. I ran inside to grab a pen and paper to draw a diagram for Joe. I dashed past my laptop, which was in its usual spot on top of our gas-only fireplace. Instead of a chimney, there was a large, flat surface that classy people would have used for decorative items, but we used to collect clutter and as a spot for my computer. I vaguely registered that there were two new emails up on the screen as I zipped by. Then I stopped. I walked backward to the computer as if someone had hit rewind. One was from Ted, the literary agent. I jumped over to the laptop and opened his note. I read his words, then read them again because I couldn't believe what I read the first time. It wasn't a blow-off. It wasn't even generic well wishes. He said that the subject of my blog could potentially make an interesting book, and then, I had to read this part three times to make sure I understood, he said that he would like to see a proposal for a manuscript. If it were good, he would be my agent. I actually stumbled back from the computer as if it had emitted a shockwave. Normally, writers had to spend months, even years, pushing through the painstaking process of sending query letters and racking up rejections. Even after that, many talented people still couldn't find agents. This opportunity was so rare and so unlikely, I was sure I must be misunderstanding something. Joe startled in his lawn chair when I burst into the front yard. I was sputtering about an email I sent to an agent after I talked to Hallie at the bookstore, which only added to the confusion. I finally calmed down enough to explain. Remember how I told you I emailed that literary agent? Just a casual check-in note?
Yeah.
He replied, and not only did he reply, but he said he'd be interested in representing a book if I wanted to write one. I mean, I'd need to do a proposal first, but...
What? Are you kidding?
His face registered happy shock. The kids had begun hovering around Joe, begging for snacks, which was the primary way they spent their outdoor playtime, so we moved over to another part of the yard.
So what do I say? I asked Joe.
You say yes.
But how could that ever work?
I'd told him about the moment I'd had at church recently, and we'd both agreed that we wanted to accept this call we felt to have more children.
Jen, come on. A top literary agent just told you he'd like to represent a book by you. You're seriously asking what you should say?
But there are real issues to consider here. I pointed out that if I said yes to Ted, I would be launching a writing career now, or at least trying. I knew from my previous interactions with this agent that he did not work with dilettantes. Not only would I have to write an entire manuscript, but I would need to take my blogging work more seriously too, since modern publishers want to see authors who are actively practicing the craft. On top of that, I probably wouldn't make any money from it for a long time. In fact, there was a real risk that I would write a book that nobody would publish, and I'd see no income from it at all. I drew in a long, deep breath. A summer thunderstorm had come through the day before, and the air felt clear and full of possibilities. Could I really take this opportunity? Sure, Joe said I should do it, but he didn't regularly spend hours agonizing about his philosophical stance on the ideal parent-child relationship, so his opinion was suspect. Since the moment I found out I was expecting my first child, I had been living in the tension between duty and passion. My desire to be a good mother came from the innermost part of my soul, that sacred space where our purest truths reside. Yet it was in that same primal place that I sensed that this work that I wanted to do was good, and that I wasn't supposed to put it on hold indefinitely. But these two things were naturally in conflict with one another. Weren't they? My views had been changing thanks to those great conversations with Hallie and Yaya and Papa. Now, for the first time, I dared to ask, what if there's no conflict? What if these things actually go hand in hand? Being part of the creation of new life was an experience of God. Yet I also felt something similar in my work. It astounded me whenever I considered that only the creatures made in the image of the Creator can create. Among all the animals on earth, humans alone have the gift of creativity. And as people had experienced through the millennia, to use this gift is to experience something of God. Now I wondered, what if all desires to create, both with children and with work, are in fact all pointed in the same direction? What if both are different but complementary ways of getting in touch with the ultimate source of creativity? What if following your God-given passion is not just okay to do during the baby years, but actually something that has potential to enhance your whole family's life? I was so lost in thought that I had to snap myself back into the real world when Joe spoke. All of your concerns are legit. There are real obstacles that we'll have to overcome. I know that. But I also know this. When a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity falls into your lap, you don't say no. If we were a more affectionate couple, I probably would have hugged him or grabbed his hand or done whatever it is that touchy-feely people do to express appreciation. As it was, I gave him a warm smile. Okay, so logistically, what would that even look like? Where would I find the time? How could I get up the energy? Joe looked at me intently as if he were about to deliver the perfect answer to this conundrum, and he said, I have no idea. I laughed. Well, it sounds like a plan then. Should I go tell Ted yes and we can figure out the details later?
Yes. Tell him you're in.
Chapter 13. The Office. The next step was to put together a proposal. I wasn't officially